Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2022 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ANRA Historical Novel Prize 2021, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ANRA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. In Sydney, on the contested corner of the Hume Highway and Parramatta Road, there's a brave little park. In summer, somehow a long cooling arbour of wisteria thrives in the noise and dust. It's called Explorers Park, so named in 1988, the site from where many European explorers began their journeys from Sydney. At one end, a large triptych of metal panels forms something of an enclosure. Ingeniously, the shadows of a drawing have been removed from the metal, so the hollows are coloured by the park. One panel depicts the explorers, proud young men, the likes of Blaxland, Wentworth, Lawson and Hume, backs erect and strong on the backs of camels, facing the viewer, one with his hand held to his eyes, gazing into the endless possibility of the horizon. In the second panel, a group of First Nations people walk away from the viewer, eyes lowered, retreating. They're so passive, forced from their land, as if accepting of their fate. In this still all too frequent representation of European exploration of Australia, Dr. Anita Heiss has read the novel Biliyarul Dungalung Duray, which challenges many of these hollow representations. Welcome, Anita, to HNSA's Imagining the Past for the 2022 season.
Mandangu, thank you for such a beautiful introduction to the conversation we're going to have today. I'm speaking to you from Mianjin, Brisbane, so I would like to say to listeners, Yiridumurung, Baladua Rajuri Gialung, Aramajibu Brunlibu Migandi Bala Williams, Yindabaladu, Waradjuri Balga Balga Galangbu, Balagi Bangbu, Balambambu, Bu Nirumbangbu, Yinjabaradu, Yagaragu, Turubugu, Mianjin Bull Main. So, what I've attempted to say, in probably with a dreadful Aussie accent, but in Wiradjuri language, was good day. My name is Anita Heiss. I have Wiradjuri belonging from Arambi and Brungal missions, and they are both in central New South Wales. I'm a Williams, and I honour my elders, those who have passed over, my ancestors, and Wiradjuri country. And today I'm obviously on Yagara and Turrbal land, and I acknowledge the traditional owners here in Mianjin in Brisbane, not only as caretakers still of country, but as the original storytellers of this place. And I do that because we are talking about storytelling and truth telling, and I acknowledge their resistance and stories over time.
Thank you for that. That was a lovely way to start the conversation. I'd like to start today with just asking you, when was the first idea you had to kind of become a writer?
It's a really interesting story. I'm sure you interview many people who talk about wanting to be a writer from childhood. But the funny thing is, the interesting thing is, I never read as a child. I didn't fall in love with reading till I was in my postgraduate degree, to be honest with you. And obviously you need to read to be a writer and be inspired and so forth. But what happened was, I was at university back in the early 90s doing my honours degree on the 1967 referendum, and pretty much every book I got off the shelf about anything to do with First Nations people, Australia, Aboriginal people, was written by a non-Indigenous author, an academic, an historian, an anthropologist. quite often those works were written by people who'd never been to Australia. And I picked a book off the shelf on my reading list, I might say, to do a seminar paper on, and it was uniquely titled Australian Aborigines. And this is back in 1991. And it was written by someone who'd never been to Australia, but it was based on letters written by someone in the new colony of New South Wales. And he would write letters back to this gentleman in the UK and say things like, oh, today I did this with the natives and today I did that with the natives and so on. And one day, five Aboriginal men took this fella hunting and they left him for a short period of time. And when they returned, there were only four of them. So he assumed they ate the fifth one. As you would. Yeah, we can laugh because it's insane. It's insane and irrational. But what happens is that moment in time he records as Aboriginal people being cannibals because five went away, four came back. So he writes this letter back to Britain. The natives are cannibals and he tells his story. And then, you know, 100 years later, I get this book off the shelves at UNSW Library. And I realised two things at that moment in time. And one is that the recording of history is completely subjective. And the way in which the colonisers remember and record history is completely different to the way in which the colonised around the world remember and record history. And so there is subjectivity in that, and the lens that writers write through and the lens that readers read through. And the second part of that epiphany, as it were, was that I needed to use the skills that I had gained during doing my honours in history to write. I had no idea what that would look like. I had no idea that I would be talking to you today, you know, having written a number of historical novels, because that was never in my landscape. But that was the turning point for me when I realised that we needed to be telling our own stories our ways.
Did you find that book by chance?
Have I found it since?
No, no. When you first found it, was it by chance or?
No. It was on my reading.
It was on a reading list, right?
That was on the reading list, and maybe the purpose of it being on the reading list was for me to pull it apart. I can't remember what I did with that paper bank then.
Right.
I'm sure.
I just miss being able to walk around library shelves because you often found things that, you know, you weren't looking for, which just changed everything.
I think this is going to be a podcast of confessions. I nearly just looked for the books I had to look for back then. It's different today, you know, because I'm a writer and I love being in library. And so it's a different experience now. But back in the day, I just wanted to pass. But that moment, that book really was the springboard to me being here talking to you today.
So your publishing history is kind of quite varied and many. You started with nonfiction, but what drew you towards fiction and in particular historical fiction?
My first novel was a historical novel for young people called Who Am I? The Diary of Mary Talents, Sydney 1937. And I was asked to write that novel for Scholastic, for the My Australian Story series. So that was my first attempt, and that novel's, you know, still on the shelves. So there'd four different covers, been translated internationally and so forth, and that was about the Stolen Generations. And I think seeing the response to that work, because there was such a lack of a work in the curriculum, on the library shelves, in people's homes, written by First Nations authors around our shared history, particularly around aspects of Stolen Generations and so forth. That, I guess, inspired me to do more. But I've moved into the chick lit commercial fiction area back in, I think I started writing in 2004. The first novel came out in 2007, and I've done five since then. And that was because I wanted to reach women in Australia who read fiction in their book clubs, you know, in the bath, on the bus, in wherever, who weren't at necessarily engaging with themes and issues and thinking about Aboriginal women at all. And so I made a strategic decision to move into that space so I could reach a broader audience about topics that I thought all Australians should be thinking about and talking about. So the NT intervention, Black deaths in custody, Indigenous intellectual property rights, trying to simplify identity, but also showing women, female audiences in particular, that we have so much in common just by being women, and trying to connect on that level of sameness so that I could then talk about what life is really like for me as a woman living in, you know, urban centres and so forth, with responsibility and accountability to community. And of course, those novels then led to me writing historical fiction, because I think the last commercial novel I wrote was in that genre, chicklet, was Titters, which did really well. It's now being turned into a play as part of the Brisbane Festival in this year. But Simon and Schuster then asked me for another novel, and I was standing in Pearl Harbor, and I'd been there before, but it was the first time that I recognized or realized that most of the people in Pearl Harbor were Japanese tourists. And I wondered how they must have been feeling and processing their shared history being told through a very American lens. And then that led me into coming back and writing Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms about the prisoners of war in Cowra, just down the road from Mirambi Aboriginal Mission, where my mother was alive during the breakout during World War II. And so that led into that. And then, you know, that then led into Billy Ada Dangalung Duray, which I know we'll talk about a bit more later. And so I think what I'm finding is a real desire by readers to be learning history. There's many people my age and probably your age who still say, oh, I learned nothing at school, which is fine to say that, but there's no excuse now for people not to be learning, because we are churning out, you know, poetry and novels and plays and films and so forth for people of our generation to be able to go and learn. So that's probably a long way around answering that question.
So what was the first kind of inkling you had to the novel Billy Yaru Dangalung Duray?
Well, it's interesting, because I knew I was going to do a novel. I'd been commissioned to write a novel about women living on the land. And that commission came in, I think, in 2017. But I didn't know. I knew it was a historical novel. I knew it was going to be in the mid-19th century. I didn't really know what the story was going to be. I wanted to show what life was like for both Indigenous and settler women. And then what happened in June of 2017, which was during the anniversary of the Great Flood of Gundagai, the unveiling of the statue of Yari and Jackie Jackie happened on the main street of Gundagai. And while I wasn't there, I watched it all unfold online. And I thought to myself, how is it that Australians do not know about two things? That this flood was the greatest natural disaster in Australian history, claiming the lives of 79 people, a third of the town. How don't they know that? And more importantly, how don't they know about these absolute Wiradjuri heroes, Yari and Jackie Jackie, who went out on bark canoes over those 3 days during raging floodwaters and torrential rain, and on their canoes that held one person managed to go out one at a time and save an estimated 59 lives. And I thought, this is it. I want this story in classrooms. I want as many Australians as possible to know this story, because most people know about the road song, the road to Gundagai. They know about the dog on the tucker box, but they really need to know about these men. And so I knew there was my opening. So that was June. I'm going to start the story there. In January, the following January, I started learning my language down at Charles Sturt University on Wiradjuri country in Wagga Wagga with Uncle Stan Grant and Letitia Harris and Yadi Lambshead and Lloyd Dolan. And every day that I spent there over the next 2 years going back and forth, everything fell into place. I didn't know when I had the idea for the novel that there would be language in there, but as soon as I started to learn, and it was very, very difficult, I thought, here's my opportunity to actually contribute just a little bit to the maintenance of language, trying to weave in as much as I learned, and I haven't learned very much at all. And it's very, very complex. It's a completely different grammar system. But I thought if I can write this story about the Great Flood, weave in language, then talk about life on country in Wagga Wagga during that period of time. So I moved the story from Gundagai to Wagga Wagga because that's where I was spending so much time going out on country, learning stories of the land, imagining standing in the floodplains there too, imagining what it was like for my ancestors, learning how to carve a coulomb and so forth, that it all, for me, just all fell into place at that time.
Why did you choose the kind of the form of a romantic epic to tell the story when you kind of think of that long history that form has? It's all pretty European.
Well, for anybody who's read my other work, all of them have a love story. Part of it is because just as Anita Heiss, it's got nothing to do with writing, but Anita Heiss believes in love and romance and laughter. And so part of me is writing, I guess, part of my own dreams on the page. But also I grew up in a house full of love. And so I know how to write love. And I think I know how to write love. And also, we very rarely read stories about romance between two black characters. It's a black man and a white woman, or vice versa. And I wanted to write a love story around the way that I see Wiradjuri people every day of my life, about, you know, strong Wiradjuri men who are respectful and hardworking and loving and kind and thoughtful, and how they live with their women, whether they were Wiradjuri or not. And so I wanted to portray our people the way I see our people, because it's not the way that we are generally portrayed in Australian literature or in the media today. And I thought, here's also an opportunity for me to tell this story about life on the land and our resilience through Wagadine and Yindjimara.
Yeah, I mean, the novel contains many innovations, I think. Like, you've spoken a little bit about this, but maybe we could just expand it. What was your process to include the Wiradjuri words, and how do you think that's been received by readers?
You know, I love talking about the language and the cover in particular. So we'll just start with the cover, if that's okay.
Sure.
Simon and Schuster, because as you may know, Iliad and Dungalung Duray was the first commercial Australian novel to have only Aboriginal language on the cover, on the front cover. So English appears on the back. And Simon and Schuster said to me, "We really want to push the boundaries. What do you think we can do?" And I said, "Well, let's just take English off the cover altogether." And I'm so pleased that in itself, that act has actually been received really well. And it's hard for me to believe now that I say it out loud that it took until 2021 for that to happen. And also, it's not a very easy title to say. As you know, you've mastered it. Thank you very much. Someone came up to me at a launch, and I haven't counted it. I think they said there's like 27 letters in that word. So, but for me also, it was about, I want people to understand when they read that novel, I want it to remind them that everywhere they walk in Australia, there is a first language, and it's not English, that what we all grew up learning as the dominant language is actually the second, third or fourth language in some communities around Australia. The audience reaction has been mind-blowing. I didn't even think about it when I was writing it. All I was concerned about, aside from the deadline, was getting the story right for the descendants of those who lost family in the flood, for getting the language right out of respect for my language teachers and my ancestors, and getting it, you know, creating a story that kept people wanting to learn more. I wasn't actually thinking about how people would react to language. I was more concerned about getting it right. But the response has been extraordinary. When I see posts on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook groups and book clubs and so forth, where people are saying that they have read the book and listened to the audiobook, because Tamala Shelton's done an incredible job there. And I think, oh my goodness, all these people are actually engaging in the book in two different formats. largely because of the language, so they can read it and hear it at the same time. And I think for me as an author and as a Wiradjuri person, I'm excited because it means more people are coming to appreciate the complexity of our language, or the beauty of our language, and with that comes a respect for us as peoples. And I think this is a really good way in which we can all move forward in terms of that need for respect and recognition.
Yeah, I'd like to just explore, you've mentioned again your process of learning the language. I'd like to explore that just a little bit more, because I mean, learning any other language, it is a different lens and a different veil that you end up looking at the world through, which can only be, you know, a positive thing to have a different subjective point of view on the world. So I'm just wondering about what that kind of impact was on you when you started learning these words.
It's incredibly empowering. There's a couple of different, well, there's different, a whole lot of emotions. There's a lot of tears in that classroom. I can tell you at some point everybody cries. I remember, I know it was Uncle Stan or someone walked in and they said, well, who's crying this week? Because there's this recognition for me. There was recognition that I was sitting in a university setting with the endorsement of a main university on country with elders in the room, learning the language that my mother was forbidden to speak, and my grandmother, who was in Cootamundra Aboriginal Girls Home, removed under the Act of Protection, my mum living under the Act of Protection and policy of assimilation on a Ranby mission in Cowra. And here I am, the first person in my family to go to university, now learning the language that was more or less outlawed back then. So there was this sense of privilege, and I cried when I, you know, when I spoke about this in the room, because I thought, I'm sitting here doing something that my old people weren't allowed to do. So there's this sense of privilege. And I was sitting in a room with old people who were learning the language because they grew up not being allowed to speak it, right? And so that was an emotional journey, I think. But now I feel really empowered. I feel it's an act of sovereignty, because sovereignty is not just about us having control over our land. It's about having control over our life experiences and our languages. And how we assert our identity. So when I have the capacity to say good morning to you in language, or to speak at a conference and acknowledge country and get the audience to even just say the title of the book, I feel like that's an act of saying, I'm asserting my right to be able to speak language that was not allowed to be spoken years ago. I mean, as you'll know, we're in the United Nations decade of Indigenous languages, because the year of Indigenous languages 2 years ago was so significant and so well received worldwide in terms of reclaiming and the need to maintain Indigenous languages around the world, that we now have this decade. And from memory, from the IATSIS website, the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies website, that listeners should go and have a quick look at when they get a minute, from memory, when they were talking about the international year, I think the numbers said that at the point of first contact or invasion, I think the website says first contact, let's just say invasion, there were about 250 distinct languages with 800 dialects, about 100 active now and 13 being taught to children. So hopefully in the years that follow, with this, you know, through a growing interest in the maintenance of language, that we can increase those numbers.
The languages that were spoken must have been so varied too, across, you know, the whole continent. They must have been completely separate languages.
I like to talk about the map of Australia like the map of Europe. All those different countries in Europe had different languages and songs and dances and foods and cultures. And so Australia is very much the same across all those different nations and countries. And, you know, there's diversity.
I think it's often easy for, in historical writing, for some of the European characters to be rendered kind of almost as Dickensian caricatures. But the character of Louise in your novel is gratifyingly faulty and complex, and she's held in this web of forces that she's not really in control of. It would have been easy, I think, for the First Nations people to have leant towards the trope of the noble savage. I'm just wondering if you were kind of aware of that and worked against that.
That didn't cross my mind. I think what I wanted to do with Louisa was I wanted to show a few things. I wanted to show the possibility and reality of relationships formed between settler and local mob, as reflected in life today. But I also wanted to show the power imbalance in those relationships, also reflective today, even when there's caring and goodwill, which Louisa had. We know that Louisa had an incredible sense of social justice. She just couldn't enact what she wanted to do, and it took some time for her to realise the centering of herself in trying to make everything work at the cost of Wagadine's freedom, without too many spoilers there. But I also wanted to show, I did a lot of reading about life on the land for women, not settler women, and there was, you know, domestic violence and there was alcoholism. And I wanted to show that though there were different kinds of difficulties, that it wasn't necessarily easy for Louisa either. And although she was moneyed and privileged and had a mind of her own, she was still stuck in this place where she couldn't really live the life that she wanted to live. That life that she wanted to live also was to help, well, supposedly to help Wagadine, but on her terms.
If the novel's told in present tense with third-person point of view, mainly through Wagadine and Louisa's, but you peppered that also with the father Yari and Yindi Amara. What was the process of deciding to use tense and these many points of view? And what do you think you kind of gained and perhaps lost with these decisions?
I think I'm trying to remember. I always wanted to open and close with Yari because that took the story full circle. And I think for me, I wanted the reader to see, for example, life on the land through Yindi. So we see when he's driving cattle and so forth, we see his experience of the land, which we wouldn't necessarily have seen otherwise, because, you know, we see him going cross country, we see the conversations he has with the other white stockmen and so forth, we see his experience with the boys when he takes them away. And we wouldn't have said, I don't know how I would have written those experiences. And they are experiences I wanted the reader to have. And I wanted to, again, similarly, I wanted the reader to get into the mind of Louisa as well, because I wanted the reader to see how Louisa viewed the people and the move and her husband and life and so forth. Interestingly, you have no control how people read your work at all once it's in the public domain. But interestingly, I know of at least one book club up here who spent their entire book club gathering talking about Louisa.
Right.
So there was something about her that triggered that group of readers. I think many of them, well, I know all of them were non-Indigenous women, full of goodwill because I know the book. But it was interesting. And so I think by actually having those different points of view, every reader could possibly potentially relate to one of the key characters. And I want that too, in a good way or a bad way. I want people to be able to see some of themselves in their values, in their ethics, in the way they view the world, and most importantly, the way they view and interact with First Nations peoples on a daily basis, or not interact.
What was the editing process like for you? Do you enjoy that process? And also, you've mentioned the cover of the book, which I think is really beautiful. How involved were you in the production of that?
Thank you. I'll do the cover first. So the cover has the goanna, a beautiful embossed goanna at the top, the Wiradjuri word Gugar, and that's the totem for much of Wiradjuri country, but definitely through Wagga. And around Wagga. And so my cousin Luke Penrith, who lives in Brungle, did that for me, gifted me that, which is beautiful. And it has a cockatoo, which is, well, it has two roles because the cockatoo was the totem of Wagadine's mother. But also, when I first went to Wagga for language lessons, I've been to Wagga many times before, but I was staying on the riverbank in a cabin, and at dusk, the cockatoos just go crazy. And these massive cockatoos and all this noise. And I went outside and I videoed it. And I'd never seen anything like it in life. And so I've written that into the story. But I think the way that it's captured on the cover, which is includes a photo of the Murrumbidgee, Billa, the Murrumbidgee River, with the cockatoo and the googar. And then, of course, the language, which we've already spoken about. So I think that's the cover. For me, a cover needs to capture the essence of the story within, and I think that cover's done a really good job. In terms of the editing process, so there's two things. I love the editing process largely because by the time I've handed the book in, I can't look at it anymore. I've looked at it and read it so many times. So you get a bit of a breather, and then it comes back with, you know, one or two pairs of fresh eyes who look at it, and that most of the time with a whole lot of ideas and suggestions to improve the work. And that's the role of the editor, not necessarily to change the content, but fix the structure, the point of view. So you mentioned point of view before that, and, you know, there'd be notes in the editors going, well, whose point of view is this? You've slipped into this point of view. And so those sort of things, you know, sometimes we'll have a conversation about if there's something that the editor wants to change or suggests needs to be removed. And if it's something that I've got my heart set on, at the end of the day, they will say, it's your book, Anita. You make the decision. But of course, I'm also want the story to be the best it can be. So sometimes there's a process of negotiation. But I, from memory, there's never been anything for this book. There was nothing that we really had to nut out, really.
How many kind of drafts did it involve, and what was the length of time for the actual writing of the whole novel?
Right. Well, I'm a plotter, so I map the story out, which makes it much easier for me. I started researching, as you know, when I had the idea down to Guy Wagga. So I was back and forth to Wagga over a period of 2 years and to Gundagai. And I wrote one of the chapters. There's a chapter in there where Yin Jumada and Wog and I first meet under the moonlight down on the river. And I wrote that in the cafe in Barcelona, where I over a Christmas one time. And so because I'm a plotter, I could go to chapter 16 or whatever it is, because I knew what was going to happen in that chapter because I'd already worked it out. So I jump around when I'm writing. So I think we had the idea in the middle of early – in the mid-2017, I delivered in COVID in June of 2020 the first draft, which actually is, you know, me going through it many, many, many times. And then it was back and forth, probably, you know, three edits, and then just bits and pieces. But by the time I sit down to write, I've done most of the research and I've plotted it out. So the writing process is much easier for me. I don't know how people write without plotting, without mapping it out. I don't know how they do it.
They must have a lot more time, I think.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It is a time thing because most of my friends are pantsers, but I have a book come out nearly, you know, every other year. Because I think that you're right. I think if for me it's a time thing. I don't, you know, I'm very scheduled. I'm very organized. Everything's timetabled, and so that's how I work. So, you know, I write my synopsis, my character breakdowns. I go through all my research. I map it out. Then I sit down to write, and then I can fill in all the gaps for when I realize what research is missing.
I once saw the plan for David Copperfield by Charles Dickens, and it was literally like the chapters were all mapped out. He had then another column with what he was achieving by doing that. So there were kind of notes next to the chapters.
Oh, I might actually do that too then.
Yeah, I think he had to do that because he was always on the move. You know, and also they were serialized, so he really didn't have a chance to go back and fix something.
Yeah, right, yes.
But it was very, very interesting to see. So which writers have really, truly inspired you?
Okay, I'm going to just give a handful of women who I turn to and who inspired me to write and who I mention all the time. So the late Ujiru Noonuc, listeners may remember her as Kath Walker, who published the first book of poetry in 1964, We Are Going. There's a charter of Aboriginal rights in there, and I turn to that all the time because I feel like that charter is as relevant today as it was back then. But just the power of her writing, and she also wrote across genres, essays, children's books and so forth. She was an activist. I got to meet her briefly when I was at UNSW, so I'll never forget that. And I think in terms of a pioneer, really inspired and motivated me in the same vein as the late Aunty Ruby Langford Guinnerby with her autobiography, Don't Take Your Love to Town, and all her work that followed that really pushed the boundaries in the publishing arena back in 1988 when that work came out, in terms of the editing process and telling her editor not to gubberize her text, which she meant not anglicize my text. So in terms of voice and being committed to maintaining the voice of your characters and your people, she really inspires me. But of course today, like Melissa Lukashenko, Alexis Wright, Jared Thomas is an extraordinary YA author, but and writes very complex stories. And I'm really inspired by my peers. So the late Rosie Scott, Georgia Blaine, I'm fans of theirs in a commercial area, Pamela Hart or Pamela Freeman. She writes under both those names. Up here in Brisbane, I'm a huge fan of, Chrissy Neen, Ashley Hay. We have a writing group. We don't actually write. Writers get together and we talk and eat. But so we have a really good support network up here, and I'm inspired by the way those women bring their stories to life as well.
What do you hope the legacy of Billy Yarra Dungalung Duray will be for First Nations people's writing?
I hope more. We have literary fiction writers. We have lots of poets. We have autobiography, memoir. But I think I'm the only one working in the commercial space, and I really hope that more writers follow me through that door, because it's about reaching big audiences, about the things that are important, and to each of us as individuals. And it's a different form of writing. So, I hope that Billy Yarra Dungalung Duray does that. I hope it inspires more writers to include language in their work. I hope it inspires their publishers to be braver in the way that they produce and publish and market First Nations writing. I'm so overwhelmed with the response to the novel. It's not what I expected. I just wanted, to be honest, I wanted my mob to be happy, and I wanted people to buy the book. And, we've gone into numerous reprints. We've got little stickers on the front now, which is lovely, thanks to the HNSA and others. I hope that that novel inspires others to maybe write the stories, historical novels, but on their own country.
It does feel like it's thrown open the doors on First Nations people's romance writing, but hopefully it does inspire other kind of subgenres within historical fiction as well. I'm just wondering, do you think there's the possibility of a pre-colonial novel?
Well, I have been asked to do both for young readers and younger readers and for adults. To write. And so there's obviously a belief in the industry that it's possible and desired. I don't know if it's possible. I think for me, it's because my novels are so research heavy. I don't know that, I don't know if it can be done, but I know that I'm not the person to do it. I'm sure that there's probably somebody somewhere having a crack.
Would be an interesting thing. I mean, there's obviously a film like 10 Canoes, which was pre-colonial. It would just be interesting to see if someone can push into that space. So
what it requires is the emphasis will be on fiction.
Mm.
We have to imagine so much. We'd have to imagine. I mean, there's documents from the point of first contact, at least on the East Coast. So it would be using those and going backwards.
They're going, imagining into the crash, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what does being shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize mean to you? And what do you see as the broader roles of these prizes?
Oh, my goodness. I was so excited when I got that email. I had I had always believed that I would win lotto, but I never believed I'd get a shortlist on the HNSA. So long list even. I was so excited. So what it did is because I've always sought validation from community, I didn't think about it from an industry point of view. And it meant that I felt like I'd been validated, my work and the story, the truth telling, my craft, me as an author had been validated by, you know, this amazing, incredible society and association. And so I value that because I felt valued. And then to be shortlisted with Gail and Jock, I mean, my goodness. And we love Jock, so we were happy he won. Oh, I was happy he won because he's just such a gorgeous man. And I think it actually puts the work into a different space and gives it a recognition that it might not otherwise had, and it reaches an audience that might not otherwise have reached. So I'm really grateful for that.
Just to finish up today, and I think this is probably going to be a long answer, knowing you. What's next for you? What are you up to at the moment?
Right. Well, I've written the children's picture book version of The Great Flood. I think we're calling it The Big Flood, and that will be launched. On the anniversary of The Great Flood next year. So I'm excited about that. I'm working on another historical novel, an epic historical novel that is due for release in 2024. And a lot of the research of that has been done, and I'll be working on that in Paris. I've got one of the Australia Council international residencies. So I'm heading there in December. So I've got 3 months. I'll be going to try and visit every one of the 57 libraries in Paris while I'm there. We're launching, I think in August it'll come out, a collection called Growing Up Wiradjuri with elders' stories that was born out of my language course where I had to do a community development project, and I decided to do this anthology. I've got a kids novel coming out in November through Magabala Books called The Koori Princess. That was just fun to write. And as I mentioned earlier, my play Titters is being produced by La Boite Theatre in collaboration with QPAC and will be part of the Brisbane Festival in September. So maybe some of your listeners might come along and enjoy that. Fingers crossed.
Goodness, that's an exhausting list of things you're working on.
We're going to have a holiday.
Well, enjoy your time in Paris, and remember, in France, they kiss on Main Street, so yeah. Romance lives.
Oh, well, I should organise another romance novel while I'm there. You're right.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I've really enjoyed this discussion, and I hope we've illustrated some of your process and some of your things you set off to do with this novel, which I really enjoyed reading.
Mundungu, Greg, thank you so much for your fabulous questions and for your interest in my work.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2022 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many illuminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction, including details of the announcement of the 2022 ARA Historical Novel Prize on the 20th of October, 2022. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.